What's good, Meaning Up fans? This is your boy RB3 here to give you a special look at a new podcast that I'm doing with my buddy John Marin, aka Mr. Marin Knows. It's called the Real Talk Film Society Podcast. Every week or every couple weeks, we'll be diving into a celebration of Black cinema. The first episode is going to be available right here on the Meaning Up podcast feed. The first couple episodes might be available on the Meaning Up podcast feed, but we also have our own podcast feed at Real Talk Film Society. Real Talk Film Society. And we're talking, you know, we're a film channel. So when we say Real Talk, it's R-E-E-L, Talk Film Society. We are available on Apple, Spotify. Currently, the YouTube version is on First Cut, but you can also subscribe to Real Talk Film Society on YouTube as well. Again, this is a podcast that's celebrating all things Black cinema. In today's episode, we are talking about the greatest Black movies ever made. We reached out to a lot of people on social media, got a little bit of a poll going, and let's see what people thought. Without further ado, let's jump into the episode.
What's up, people? This is Mr. Marin here. This is the first episode of the Real Talk Podcast. Mr. Marin, my boy RB3 here. What's up, brother?
How you doing, man? Good to have you, man. Good to be on this podcast.
Absolutely. This is gonna be a normal thing. We're gonna try to do it. You know, every week, every month, we'll figure out the formula to this. What we're trying to do with this is have some real talk, real dialogue. So it's like two brothers. We might have guests on eventually, you know, with the time. Right. But we're just gonna have real chat about film and give it from a different perspective, because I feel like our voice is often missing in film dialogue. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
So whether it be, you know, Black film or just mainstream, anything, you know what I'm saying? We're going to always give our take. Art is open to interpretation and criticism. So, you know, you kind of need different voices at all times to kind of get into the nitty gritty of things. You know what I'm saying?
Mm-hmm.
So this episode, you know, it's Black History Month.
Yep.
I figured, why not kick off the show with the ranking of the greatest Black films of all time? Yeah. I put out a poll out there. I know you put it out there too. Mm. I collected a lot of data. It was some interesting choices. You know, somebody said Norbit. Norbit made it in there. I don't know. It didn't make it far. I say that much. It was only one person that said Norbit out of everybody I collected. But I collected some data, and it was pretty interesting. It might be films that you would expect to be on that list, but the ranking of it is what threw me off. I was just like, oh, okay, this might be a little different. So I'm just going to throw some films out there, you know, discuss the ranking, discuss the film briefly, and then at the end, we'll try to figure out, was it ranked properly? Do you think it should be lower or higher? You know what I'm saying?
And these are all from Instagram.
All from Instagram.
Okay.
Instagram, and I did reach out to people on the side too.
Okay.
Because I'm just like, look, like, I had a lot on Instagram, but it was like, I know too many people. I got a lot. So I sat there, I broke it down. Where's my phone? Here we go. Before I start off with five, I'm going to bring up the ones that didn't make it. You know what I'm saying? We just see what we think of.
And we're going to put out our own, like, top five.
Of course.
We got to talk about our own.
Absolutely. Right, absolutely. Yeah. So the honorable mentions, you know. There's New Jack City. Need I say more about that? Wesley Snipes, Alan Payne, a star-studded cast. You already know about that. Straight Outta Compton made it.
Some Blu-ray roll right there.
You know, it's
right
fitting because we are live in Compton right now. This is very fitting.
Compton, California, baby.
Yo, so, you know, we got that. Hollywood Shuffle. There was some fun. Moonlight.
Moonlight. Oh, really? Really?
If Beale Street could talk. Yes.
Barry Jenkins.
I need to see that one. I didn't see that one yet.
That was my favorite film of that year.
Really?
Yeah.
When it came out, I was too busy, so I didn't get to see that one. Life.
That's a timeless.
That's an all-time Eddie Murphy film. Like, I feel like whenever people talk about Eddie Murphy, they want to talk about the Beverly Hills Cops and 48 Hours. Life always gets left out the shuffle. And we're talking Bernie Mac, you know what I'm saying? Miguel A. Nunez, who is a well-known Black actor. He does a lot of stuff, and he's really good. He plays, what's the dude that was with Bernie Mac? Spoiler alert, he gets shot.
Oh, man.
I forget his name in the movie. He was good in it. Clockers.
Oh, Spike.
Spike came up a lot, which goes without saying. He's the godfather of modern Black cinema.
Absolutely.
So, of course, Spike is going to come up. Death by Temptation. Have you ever seen that movie?
I don't know if I've seen that movie, actually.
Death by Temptation is a Troma film. You know, Troma is the distributor that makes all the B-movies, that video B-movies, horror movies, The Toxic Avenger and all that stuff. They actually put out this film in 90, I believe it's 90. And it was James Bond III who plays the geeky, nerdy dude in School Days. He's part of that. Him, he's in that. He stars, directed, wrote it, produced it. Sam Jackson is in it. Bill Nunn is in it. Freddie Jackson is in it.
Really?
Freddie Jackson cameo is in it. This was really good. It's if you didn't know any better, you would have thought it was a Spike film because there's so many of the same faces from around that time. That's that 40 Acres camp. Them same actors, they're in Death by Temptation. It's basically like a demon, I guess a succubus, a woman that goes to these bars to kill these men. And then James Bond III is like a Christian that moves into Brooklyn and fights her. It's very good. Kadeem Hardison's in it. Sam Jackson is in it.
Yeah.
It's a good
movie. Wow, you put me on a...
Yeah, we're going to do a deep dive on that eventually.
Got to.
Eventually. How to Be a Player. That made the list somehow. I mean, that was, you know, it's a cool movie. You know what I'm saying? Boomerang is not in the top five.
Yeah.
That's an important film for me.
Mm.
So, let's get into it. Number five. On the greatest black films of all time is the 1988 classic, Eddie Murphy, Coming to America.
Right.
Not Coming to the number two America, the sequel, which was okay.
Yeah.
Coming to America. What's your thoughts on Coming to America?
Man, that's, that's another time with Eddie Murphy. You know what I mean? I think a lot of Eddie's filmography is, you can't touch it. It's pretty locked in stone. And I think that one... You know, before there was like a Wakanda and before there was this idea of like this mythical black nation that we, you know, come from, that put that on screen and it kind of portrayed it in a way that was funny and a way that was, you know, some might consider it insensitive. You know what I mean? If you're like African.
Right. Yeah.
if you're like one of those cultures they're kind of like riffing off of.
Yeah.
But for the most part, it's pretty inoffensive. You know, it's a story that's a romance comedy at the end of the day.
Yes.
And I think we don't have a lot of films that are just purely about black joy, black love, and like about that kind of situation.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it was kind of ahead of its time in that way of, it was almost like not weirdly, but it was acknowledging blackness, but like celebrating it too.
Yes.
Before it was like commonplace to do that in cinema.
Yes, and the interesting thing about that film coming out when it did, this is 2 years after She's Gotta Have It, put black cinema on the pulpit, you know. And this is Eddie Murphy, who's hot, fish grease hot Eddie Murphy. We talking
SNL.
Yeah, SNL, just after, way after SNL, but this is like Beverly Hills Cop. Golden Child on a smaller level.
48 hours
for sure. Like, this is even after Beverly Hills Cop 2, which I think, no, it didn't make more money than the original, but still, he was Eddie Murphy, and this is the first little inkling of Eddie Murphy going into all black cast type situation. What throws this one off and what makes it so different from the Boomerang, which was really like, you know, all black everything, black excellence. What throws this off is that John Landis is directing this one.
Right.
You know what I'm saying? This is actually, this film is famous for him and John Landis getting into a physical fight on set. And I think,
really?
Yeah.
Okay, I didn't know this.
Yeah, you they got...
Tell me about this.
Yeah, they got... It was something that, they got into it on set. And, I think Eddie goes on Arsenio Hall's show maybe a year later and says, not only says that he doesn't want to work with John Landis again, but then he's like, you know, ask Vic, what's the guy's name from Twilight Zone? Cause you know John.
Yeah, he killed that.
Vic Morrow. He was like, ask Vic Morrow. Oh, Vic Morrow has a better chance of working with John Landis than I do. Mind you, at that time, Vic Morrow was dead. So it was like... Eddie really went for the jugular on that one. You know what I'm saying? But, you know, going back to what you said about it being a romantic comedy, you know, yeah, this is the first time. I think this is the first time we really see that from Eddie. I think Eddie, up until that point, is the wisecracking, fast-talking.
A lot of cops.
Yeah, you know, wisecracking, fast-talking, and real asshole jerk, you know, funny guy. But, you know, this is the time we see him fall in love, you know what I'm saying? Played by... Sherry Headley, I believe is her name. You know, Arsenio Hall is in it. Sam Jackson is in it. You know, this one is definitely, this is definitely ahead of its time and very timeless. You know what I'm saying? This is one of those you could quote for days. You know what I'm saying? You could sing the she's yours. You know what I'm saying? Right, you could quote this one for days, and this is a classic film. I appreciate the fact that it is in the top five, because this is one of those very important films, especially for our culture.
Yeah, and it's, I like the fact that we got some comedy representation.
Absolutely.
I don't know what other comedy films are going to
have. Yeah, well, we'll see. Yeah. But I will say this. Central to a lot of black films is the most memorable ones are comedies, because, yeah, we deal with the subject matter of being black alone. It could, you know, lead to black trauma, quote unquote, and a lot of things like that. And we often, historically, we've always kind of gravitated towards comedy to kind of laugh at life a little bit, just to make things a little light. You know what I'm saying? So that's there. Eddie Murphy's Coming to America was number five. So for number four on this list, and this one is a shocker because I didn't expect it to be so low. It's still in the upper top five, but it's low. 1989's
Do the Right Thing?
Do the Right Thing.
Really?
Yes.
Wow, number four.
Number four. This is considered Spike Lee's magnum opus. Can we agree on that one?
Yeah.
Do the Right Thing. You know, if you don't know about Do the Right Thing, it takes place on one block in Bedford-Stuyvesant, Brooklyn, where things start off calm. You know, it's a hot day. Everybody got their own shit going on. People getting these shoes, you know, Jordan's getting stepped on, whatever, whatever. And the film escalates naturally. You know, I don't, you know, we all kind of know what happens, but, you know, it's a big riot. You know, Sal's pizzeria burns down. And this all stems from bugging out, wanting black people on the wall.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I think this is Spike's best script. I don't think it's his best film. Mm. I think it is his best script, because if you follow Spike's stuff, his scripts tend to be a little heavy-handed. You know, they kind of lose its path, you know, by the time we get halfway to the film. Yeah. He's heavy on the subplots. So, you know, even with Jungle Fever, you know, you come in thinking it's a film about interracial romance, and you get this whole, which is excellent. That could have been a film on itself about Gator and the whole, you know, Gator being a crackhead and the crack epidemic. And which that alone was an answer to critics from Do the Right Thing that said that this is unrealistic. There's no crack. White critics.
Why would you? Yeah, like,
white.
And you see a black movie with, you know, all black cast, and you got to think of the crack.
This is why we are here, my brother. This is why we are here, because we all know film criticism prior to the 21st century was very, very white controlled. You know what I'm saying?
How it was.
That's how it was. Look at Boomerang. There's a beautiful clip of Eddie Murphy on the Jay Leno show, kind of defending Boomerang, because there's white critics that said there was no white people in this movie. So it can't, this is a unreal, this is a fantasy. There's no, like, they were really offended there was no white people in the movie.
Wow.
So same thing. A lot of people complained that there was no crack in this film, which is crazy.
I just think that's just,
but
it's just comical when you just say it out loud.
Yeah, shit sounds ridiculous. But, you know, that's where we at with it. So Do the Right Thing. How do you feel about Do the Right Thing?
Do the Right Thing is legit, you know, probably one of my favorite, if not, you know, top three favorite movies of all time. It's comical how many times we had to watch it in film school. Yeah. You know what I mean? Probably like three or four different classes. Yeah. We had to like watch Do the Right Thing. I wrote a paper, Do the Right Thing, which I'm sure a lot of, you know, black film school people and a lot of people who are general cinema lovers have talked about Do the Right Thing. It's often regarded, like you said, famous Oscar snub. The fact that it only was nominated for Best Original Screenplay, didn't get a Best Picture nomination.
Best Support, and Danny Aiello got Best Support.
Best Supporting
nomination, but he lost to Denzel in Glory. When you see that tear,
I mean, that's
it was over. It was over. But Spike didn't get the Best Director or Best Picture.
Yeah,
which happens later on again in his career. Spike is he's an interesting figure in film. I think that, you know, he's very underrated as a filmmaker. I think he gets his love as a filmmaker and for the strike, but in the same token, he's not awarded the love that the Spielbergs get.
Absolutely.
The George Lucas, who, let's be real about George Lucas, man. Like, okay, you gave us Star Wars.
Right.
American Graffiti and Star Wars.
Right. Two good ones. Those are good.
That was it.
They're cool.
That was it. He didn't give us the best Star Wars movie. I'm sorry. Like, and then he gave us the prequels, which was, you know, depending on what you're looking for in a Star Wars film. It could be up or down.
Right.
Yeah, so this one, man, you got Public Enemy, Fight the Power.
Yeah.
Blasting all throughout. I saw Do the Right Thing This was the summer of 2000. Mm. And I remember I was at school and my friend Gilbert, he was like, yeah, I have this movie where this girl does this dance. And he was like, you know, doing the Rosie Perez dance. And we thought that was so funny. I'm like, what movie is this? Mm-hmm. And he gave me the tape and it was Do the Right Thing, man. I remember It was that moment that I realized I loved film. Like, I knew Jungle Fever I'd seen prior, and I knew I wanted to be an actor. Well, I said that then. Mm-hmm. I wanted to be an actor. But Do the Right Thing is the film that made me appreciate film and filmmaking, because you have Ernest Dickerson cinematography, which...
Gorgeous.
I could watch that movie in the middle of a blizzard and think it's hot. You know what I'm saying?
That's what my essay was. It was for cinematography.
Okay.
And it was about how they induced the feeling of hotness, and how they, at sometimes they would take the... I forget what those little canisters are that put the heat out underneath the
I know what you're talking about.
Sometimes they'll put those directly underneath the lens to kind of make the ash fog seem like it's heating up, steaming up, like camera effect. Everything from the color, the fact that, you know, the wall that we see Robin Harris and all the other cast, it's a bright white wall, so it kind of emulates that heat, that red hot feeling. Mm-hmm. So it's like all these like really clever tricks to, like you said, emulate the heat, the building of the tension, and also plays into the story of it, right? Yes. So it's like, it's a really beautiful piece of cinema overall. I think, you know, I don't know if you posted that clip or I saw that clip somewhere of Kim, the actress who, even at the Oscars during that
Kim Basinger.
But there is one film missing from this list that deserves to be on it, because ironically, it might tell the biggest truth of all. And that's Do the Right Thing.
You know, and people were upset with her for even doing that.
Yeah.
They were just kind of like, you know, like, what the hell? Like, you know, that she just broke the script to do that. You know what I'm saying? Yeah, no, she's absolutely right. And I mean, that's one of those films, man. It's just
cinematography,
like...
Cinematography, writing, music.
I have a list of perfect films. One of these days, we're going to break down that list. And that's definitely on it. I mean, beat for beat. The film, I watched the film, I don't know how many times, seen it in theater. You know, theater will elevate any experience. Oh, yeah. And I was glued to it as if it was the first time I was watching it. Mm. You know what I'm saying? And like I said, Spike's best script. In my opinion, not his best film, definitely up there. But best script you got. And then the genius, Do the Right Thing. The genius in the title. You're faced with a situation with Mookie. He just watched his friend being killed. He works for Sal, people that have been good to him. And he's, the way it plays out.
Right.
And you know, to this day, you know, Spike to this day says that people come up to him and ask, why did you do that? Why did Mookie do that? Like, people are really upset that Mookie even threw the trash can into the pizzeria. Mm-hmm. And then you get hit with them MLK and Malcolm X quotes. Like, everything about that film was to create dialogue, and it was perfect. Just a beautiful, beautiful film. One of the greatest films, period, of all time. Like, forget just black film. Just very important film. Indeed. And this is why it's being taught in schools all over the place.
Yeah, as it should be.
As it should be.
Yeah.
As it should be. Now, number three is a tie. And I tried to find ways to break. I even asked more people to break this tie. And
it still got tied.
It still ended up tied.
Right.
Two comedies.
Okay.
You have 1990s House Party.
Okay.
And 1995's Friday.
Friday.
Now, we are in Compton again. Mm-hmm. Now, I wasn't in the West Coast. I'm a New York dude. If you can't tell from the way I talk, I'm from New York. How was Friday when it hit? Hold on. You might be too young to even remember that.
You're right. So, yeah, I was going to say, I wasn't born when Friday came out. Friday came out in 95. I was 97.
I went to go see that film. I remember my grandmother used to work at the Ziegfeld Theater in Manhattan, RIP to the Ziegfeld Theater. And either Casino or Braveheart was showing at the time. I remember I saw it at her theater that day. Then my mom came and picked me up. We went to the Criterion Center in Times Square. It's now a big-ass Gap. But that's where I saw Friday in theaters. Dr. Dre music video before the movie started.
Really?
Yes. Yeah.
Nice.
Yeah, they played the video before the movie started and everything. So I have vivid memories of Friday. Instant classic.
Yeah.
I know I was like 7 years old when I saw it, but the way my mom was crying in that theater, crying, laughing, that is instant classic. Yeah. You have Ice Cube. I want to say DJ Pooh helped write the script.
DJ Pooh also helped write,
Another great script. Mm-hmm. Perfect script. Yeah. You get a scenario, a day in the life of Craig and Smokey on one block, a cast of characters, Chris Tucker, Bernie Mac, John Witherspoon,
Nia Long, yeah,
Debo played by Tiny Lister,
you stayed at my grandma's. He used to from my grandma's block. Yeah,
really.
Yeah.
Oh my wow. Yeah, man. If we missed anybody, let us know. But
well, yeah, it's that cast. And I gotta say, like, you know, you talk about that West Coast thing. Like, so I didn't see it. I was too young to see it in theaters. But my mom's she barely sees any movies in theaters.
But she went to see this,
and I'll tell you, like, we. In terms of a movie I've probably seen the most, like, on pure watch factor of, like, how many times I've rewatched it, Friday is, like, easily the top.
Oh, yeah.
And it's the top for me because there was a period where probably, like, every other week my little sister on my dad's side would come over.
Okay.
And me, my mom, and my sister would all watch Friday, like, every other week, like, for almost, like, a year. Like,
wow.
Yeah, if not Friday 1 and Friday 2, just the first Friday, like.
I mean, that's so all you need to watch.
Yeah. And
granted, next Friday, Friday the next, they're cool, but they're not, and I say this, they're entertaining, but they're not good films. Like, Friday is a good film.
Great film, yeah.
Like, great, beginning to end, another perfect script. Another perfect film. That's another one on my perfect film list.
Yeah.
Which, again, we're going to break this down one day, but I have a dope perfect film list. And I mean, Ice Cube wrote the hell out of this one. Mm. And he has just one of the, he, not only is a great writer as far as a rapper, but like for him to put together this film the way he did, it's incredible. And
I also want to shout out F. Gary Gray too. You know what I mean? His directorial debut.
That's
For a director's first movie, and we actually look at a lot of the shots too, like the shot where when they're pulling out of the liquor store, and then we hear the car do the exhaust pop you see AJ who AJ went Johnson. To my mom's high school. That's what I'm saying. Like, this, they got literally everybody from like Compton, South Central. Like, it's very. It's, you can still go to Craig's house; it's still there.
Yeah.
So in the block. So it's like. It's very true. But yeah, but you see homie, my neck and my back.
Yeah, Ezel.
You know, you see him running off after he thinks it's like a gunshot. Mm-hmm. It's like all these like subtle details when Chris Tucker Smokey he's on the angel desk. It's like it's just every single scene is very
that scene in particular. I remember the movie theater. It was like y'all ever watch Def Comedy Jam and see how Negroes just rah, like they did. Yeah. That scene when he got high on the angel dust, he was running down the block and it was like sped up. People were going crazy over that scene in theater when it was out. This is like, and like, there's just no experience better than the movie theater experience, man. Especially experiencing something in real time. You're not, you know, this is not a retrospective screening where, you know, everybody knows where the jokes is coming. Everybody's laughing harder because they know the joke. This is day one. This is people seeing this movie for the first time and they were losing it in that theater, especially with that scene. And like you, I'm glad you said that, the little details in the film all throughout, the little things that if you look in the background, you see, it's just, this film is hilarious. It is hilarious. You could watch it over and over again. And fun fact, this is Michael Jordan's favorite film.
Really?
Yes.
I did not know that.
This is Michael Jordan's favorite film. I read that somewhere. I want to say Vibe magazine or something. They did a poll, and yeah, this is his favorite film.
Dang, okay.
So that's good to know.
Yeah, that's crazy, yeah.
Now, another film filmed or shot out in the West Coast, but I wouldn't say it's a West Coast story. House Party.
Yeah.
House Party, 1990s House Party. We said this, but I've said this before. This is one of the most important teen comedies, American teen comedies. I think this is right there in the conversation with all the classic films like 16 Candles, Breakfast Club, all of that. Like, I know it's hip-hop, I get it. But this is one of those ones, man. I think this is one of those ones. It's a very relatable story. You're catching hip-hop just as it's becoming mainstream. And I think that's the beautiful thing about that film, is you're seeing it in, like, it's like lightning in a bottle. You're seeing it happen right before your eyes because we're coming off of, you know, it's kind of, hip-hop is pop now. But it's kind of crazy to think that there was a point in time when people thought it was a fad. People did not see hip hop lasting more.
Yeah, people like Will Smith, you know what I mean? Yeah. Doing the parent rap and stuff. Yeah, you know? So it's like, you can kind of see how.
Yeah. Even Curtis blowing them, you know, it's like, it's real corny shit. But now, you know, we're talking post 88, hip hop is really becoming a thing. Yo, MTV Raps is on TV. Kid and Play got a cartoon after this movie. That goes to show you how how they were. They were on top of the world.
It's on HBO Max too, I think.
The movie?
I think the cartoon.
It's on HBO Max?
I think. I mean, I think while I was on.
Do not tell me that, because I'll binge watch it right now.
Maybe I'm tripping, but I think while I went back to watch House Party recently, and then I think under the recommendation, it has some cartoons.
Shout out to HBO Max, man.
But I could be wrong on that. Like, let me know if I'm wrong in the comments.
Okay, cool. Yeah, definitely, but. Nonetheless, shout out to HBO Max. They do have a good film library. I will say that.
Yeah.
But House Party, we got Martin Lawrence. This is the first time we've seen Martin Lawrence and Tisha Campbell
in a movie. Screen. Yeah. Oh, yeah. And that's crazy, too, because Martin is one of my favorite shows ever. And
my favorite.
Yeah. And they're, the fact that they have some scenes interacting, but the fact that just that little energy, you know, you can kind of tell, like, both of them are kind of like the snap. Like, Kid and Play are obviously the stars.
Right.
But of the two side characters, like, those two are, like, obviously the standouts. Like, the scene when Martin gets left outside with all of his, you know, they took the DJ stuff. And, to me, just the reaction when the homeboy pulls back in, he's just sitting there just so distraught. It's hilarious. It kills me every single time.
Yes. It was like, your mom is a bitch. Is that? No, this is later. This is when he pulls up. It's like, Bilal's in the house. The girl's like, dragon breath. you know, but shout out to Robin Harris steals this film.
Mm.
Every time Robin Harris is on screen, and I think we see this later with House Party 3. Same thing with Bernie Mac. Bernie Mac does the same thing. They're not in the film, the entire film, but the times that they're on screen, it's like an ISO play in basketball. It's like, everybody move out the way. Like, let him handle the rock. You know what I'm saying? When he walks into the party and he's just roasting everybody, you know?
Yeah.
Cops don't have no problem for you. Follow the drip. You know, AJ Johnson is there with the Jerry curl.
Right.
AJ Johnson, he's an extra.
Mm.
You know what I'm saying? Ezell from Friday is an extra in House Party. Mm. And then we have the other AJ Johnson that plays Tisha Campbell's friend, Shireen.
Mm-hmm.
She looked great, man. That movie, I don't think it aged well. There's one scene that didn't age well. And I think I seen an interview where Kid even mentions it, is when he gets arrested. His whole rap is like kind of, you know, homophobic.
You know, that's the time. That was the times. I will say the thing that didn't age as well for me was the goofy cops. Like, in general, like it's funny because during this time period, we definitely saw a lot of bad cops on film. Obviously, like Boys in the Hood was a perfect example. Mm-hmm. And obviously a lot of black movies were starting to demonstrate on screen, you know, the struggle that we deal with in real life, right? But this movie definitely put more of a comedic spin on it, and it definitely did it. I thought it in the beginning it was kind of funny, but like every time we kind of cut back to it, I thought, hey, I kind of just wish we could.
Yeah, especially when they get full force and they're like, oh, we're gonna take care of them, you know, but you know they're about to go beat them.
A year later
is Rodney King.
Yeah, you know what I'm saying? Yeah.
So. You know, but again, black folks, we got to laugh to keep from crying. You know what I'm saying? Because we know that that's real. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
And the soundtrack, everything about this film is beautiful. A lot of OGs I've talked to, they're like, yo, when it came out, theaters were like overselling seats. People were sitting on the floor to watch this film.
Really?
Lining up against the wall in theaters to watch this
film. Man, that sounds fun because just the dancing in this movie is like, and the fact, you know, obviously when you make movies, you know you can't be playing music on set.
I hate most about the remake. The remake should have been its own film.
Yeah.
Inspired by House Party. You know what I'm saying?
Mm.
That dance scene, like,
oh yeah,
that's where Tinashe comes out of nowhere. Oh girl, is this Tinashe? It's like, wow. And they do this whole choreographed dance. It's like, just some things is just sacrilege. Just leave it alone. Like, you know, but I get it. It's a remake, so they wanted to throw that in there.
Mm.
But that dance scene, and it's iconic. It's iconic if you ask me. You know what I'm saying? One thing that I did love, but it pops up in the sequel, is the character. You know, it was Groove Be Chill. That was a real rap group at the time. It was the skinny, dark-skinned brother And then the buff brother that was drinking a lot, he's drinking in the kitchen, taking it back to, he's trying to put Kid onto some beers. And then when he goes to dance, he passes out and stuff like that. And the whole movie, it deals with him being drunk. Mm-hmm. He pops up in House Party 2. Mm-hmm. And there's a scene where they're showing a bunch of brothers posted up in the wall, against the wall, and they all pass in the 40. And he's there, but he's now a Muslim brother. Yeah. And he's like, I'm going to have to pass on that, my brother. See that thing? And he goes to... I love that.
He has my change.
Yeah, House Party 2 is one of them films. It's stupid. It's not as good as House Party 1, but it's still entertaining. But no, House Party 1 is the gold standard as far as all those films go. And as far as teen comedies go, I love it. Yeah. And that was number 3, folks.
Those are three. I mean, actually, yeah, we got 3-4 movies so far.
Yeah, but three was tied.
Yeah, 3 spots. And 2 Robin Harris appearances, what I mean?
Yes.
Do the Right Thing and House Party. Yeah.
Yes. Now, for the top 2 black films of all time, we are staying in California. I think you know where this is going.
Oh.
1991 feature film debut, the late, great John Singleton.
Yes, sir.
Boys in the Hood. Rob, you take it.
Man, listen, I mean, I've told you this before, John, but Boys in the Hood is the movie that inspired me in so many ways to get into film. Avatar, the blue people movie, mm-hmm. whatever, is what kind of made me want to be a director.
Okay.
But The Boys in the Hood, particular. I saw Boys in the Hood when I was about 11 years old.
Okay.
And that movie showed me what it felt like to capture an environment, to capture your world. What I mean? And, my mom has showed me this movie a bunch of times over the years. Mm-hmm. But reading up on this movie and reading up on John Singleton in mm-hmm. particular, somebody, a brother who was from South Central, mm-hmm. Went to USC. This was his first screenplay that, he wrote, and he was Lawrence Fishburne's security guard, at the time.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Yeah. And he, soft pitched the script to Lawrence, like, I got this script. Like,
cut you off. Mm. That's often cringe when you're on set and you see people do that.
Yeah.
But then when you do hear that success comes from it, it's like, oh shit, like, that's really cool. Like, I didn't. Right. Lawrence Fishburne, I did not know that.
Yeah. And, it's probably one of them things, like, he just got out of film school.
He's so small. But then
he is a small dude.
But then Lawrence Fishburne is kind of small, too, because I've ran into Lawrence Fishburne before, but John Singleton is small. He was a security guard?
I think so, yeah. At least I think, I might be misremembering that, but I think I read that in, like, a variety piece, about that. But yeah, it was, just having that, just knowing that, hey, like, somebody from, from where I'm from, relatively South Central Compton, could go to SC. I always wanted to go to SC just because I loved, being from this area. Just love the campus. Could go to SC, go to film school there, and then make a career and make a movie that is not only impactful and important, but also just like entertaining too. Mm-hmm. Like if you watch everybody talks about when Morris Chestnut gets shot, Ricky gets shot. Of course, obviously, but I think if you watch the film up and before that point, it's actually madly entertaining. Like,
yes.
We get a lot of pockets of different black culture. We get when they're in the backyard during the barbecue, mm-hmm. playing dominoes. We're hoping for that aspiration of Ricky to get that USC scholarship.
Yes.
But at the same time, we're kind of caught up in this romance with Cuba Gooding Jr.'s mm-hmm. character. It's like a deeply entertaining, kind of melodramatic, definitely a little bit more melodramatic if you watch it now. But it's a film that's seemingly capturing life, and then the feeling of that life just being snatched away from you in an instant is something that black people in general have to deal with.
Yep.
Let alone in 90s South Central. If my mom's generation will tell you, mm-hmm. that the gang life, the act, mm-hmm. That was real. Like mm-hmm. what they was doing back then. It's a lot different now. Shout out to Compton, shout out to South Central, shout out to everywhere in the hood. Things are a lot different now, but things back then, those are real stories of real black people mm-hmm. In those situations. So, but yeah, it's a great film, one of my favorite movies of all time.
So. Yeah, same here.
It's also on the wall up there, my bad. All right. You know what I mean? Yeah.
Oh, you got the steelbook. Okay.
Yeah, yeah.
I wholeheartedly agree. I saw this as a kid. This film and Menace to Society was what made me afraid of California. I was like, I used to say, I am never going out there. These Negroes are shooting each other. I am never going out there. You know, shout out to growth because, you know, with time I learned, you know, that's not how it is. Okay? Right. You know, it happens, right. But.
It still is a little bit. A little bit. Yeah.
But that's everywhere. Everywhere you got your rough pockets. Mm-hmm. You know what I'm saying? But, I love this film, man. Another great soundtrack.
Yes.
You know, a memorable scene is Cuba rapping to Nia Long, Brandy. While just me and you was playing Tony. I love that record, and it always just takes me back to that scene every time I hear it. Ice Cube film debut.
Yes.
You know, John Singleton famously took him to Cannes when they were screening the film. That one, man, that Ricky scene to this day is hard to watch, because just like you said, you hit on it perfectly. You start to root for him. You start to root for, you know what I'm saying? And I cannot remember how I felt the first time I seen the film, because I saw it when I was so young. But I can imagine just being in the theater and seeing that play out. You know what I'm saying? Mm. I'm pretty sure there was not a dry eye in that.
Oh,
theater.
Yeah. Not to cut you off, but even if you go back and, you know, we talk a lot about how white critics were reacting. Mm. Even if you go back and read a lot of those reviews, even white critics were like really crying and really moved by that Ricky moment, you know? And that's what makes it so unique, in the fact that like John Singleton was both the first black director nominated for the Oscar for Best Director, and the youngest at just 24 when this movie came out.
Crazy when you think about that. Crazy.
So it's just like, yeah, it was impactful and it was raw and it was honest. Mm-hmm. And that's what I think like made it so hard to watch.
Yeah. Yeah. Even the another scene that gets me, just cause it's implied. Well, not implied. They tell you. But Ice Cube, that whole last scene with him and Cuba Gooding Jr., where, you know, his brother is gone, and he's just talking about it, and then for him to walk off, fade, and it's just like, man, he was killed not long after that. Like, the film, it's a lot. It's very strong. Honestly, you know, I've seen people over the years kind of downplay it. You know what I'm saying? But I think it might be a regional thing, because, again, I'm from New York, so there's a lot of people that I've seen will like champion Paid in Full over in the Hood. And I'm just like, no, like,
it's, I mean,
you know what I'm saying?
Paid in Full was good. I think what some people on retrospective, you know, I could see in retrospective, if you watch this movie now, you say like, this movie might be a little bit too sad, a little bit too melodramatic or something. Or you could say, you know, it might be playing into a little bit heavier that black trauma aspect that we were talking about earlier. But I do think, you know, like I mentioned before, there's a lot of entertaining scenes that lead up to that. And I think you go back and watch, the dialogue is so funny, so smart, so quippy. Like the way the whole group interacts with each other. The homie in the wheelchair, just their dialogue, their back and forth. When they're in the car, how they're talking about, is God a woman, you know, and they're kind of having that whole dialogue.
Yeah.
And then like, if God was a big, you know, like, just like all these lines that you just wouldn't expect, but it's just great, genuine writing too.
I love the him lying about sleeping with the chick.
Me
and my grandmother, because we had the VHS, we used to watch that, and my grandmother, he's lying. He's like, because I didn't understand, you know, I was too young. I thought the scene was just playing out as it happened. But when you get older and you realize, and then it cuts back to Lawrence Fishburne kind of looking at him like, Negro, please. You know what I'm saying? I love moments like that. And like you said, it was a very strong script. Everything about it, it's a really, really good movie.
I'll say, like, John Singleton's signature to me is his dialogue. And I think if, you know, when you watch this movie and you watch, you know, Baby Boy, I think to me, you know, the stories are always strong, but to me, the dialogue is what like really makes it stand out and really makes it that extra naturalistic feel. And that's why you get a debut actor like Ice Cube for somebody like a rap, I don't want to downplay, you know, rappers going into the acting thing, but we've seen it 100 times and 99 times it doesn't work. But I think the reason it works with Cube is because the dialogue was a custom fit to him. I think every character was written with, you know, kind of a person in mind, Angela Bassett playing Cuba Gooding's mother in that. So it's like every actor, every performance was just fine tuned, really specific, really carefully, and placed and plotted.
John Singleton is incredibly lucky. He got Angela Bassett before she became Angela Bassett.
Yeah. No, really.
Like, nah, yeah. We're like 2 years away from What's Love Got to Do with It, mm-hmm. which is insane to think about. Like, that's one hell of a debut film. You know, he got lucky, man. That you know, shout out to John Singleton again. Rest in peace. One of our greats. You know what I'm saying? Yeah. It's a shame that people didn't really appreciate his films after yeah. Boys in the Hood.
Yeah.
You know, I feel like Poetic Justice and Higher Learning, and it's definitely Rosewood, a lot of them were just nitpicked to hell. Like, yeah. It's like, I feel like these, I mean, of course, Boys in the Hood is the cream of the crop, but these films are also good in its own way, very entertaining.
Yeah.
You know what you said about the dialogue being the signature? You might be absolutely right. As you're saying, I'm thinking about scenes of Poetic Justice where they, you know, Joe Torre and Tupac is just going at it. Mm-hmm. I'm like, yo, you might be right. You know, I like his tension. Mm-hmm. When there's tension in a John Singleton film, you can feel that shit. Like the minute there's a scene in Boys in the Hood where the music's just like, boom, and it just kind of zooms mm-hmm. in on, you know, Regina King in High Learning when she gets called a bitch by the white boy on the phone.
Yeah.
And it's just mm-hmm. like, yo, tension in his films are just amazing. I love it. I love it. It works well. And definitely, yeah, he was the youngest and the first African-American director to be nominated for Best Director. That is
one
hell of a debut. Mm. But you heard the films. Let's go through the films one more time. So we started at number 5 with Coming to America. Followed that up with Do the Right Thing again. That was too low for me, but I'll take it. It was a tie with House Party on Friday, and then number 2 is Boys in the Hood. And for number 1, the greatest black film of all time, Rob, do you have a film in mind?
I mean, I feel like there's one that hasn't been named yet that I feel like maybe should be named.
So. And I'm going to tell you, Spike Lee's Malcolm X, 1992, the greatest film of all time, in my opinion.
Mm.
Black, white, red, green, don't matter. Greatest film of all time. I am born in 1988. You know, I saw Malcolm X when it came out. Mm. This is before I saw, what's this, Orson Welles? Citizen Kane.
Yeah.
This is before I saw, what you call, all the films is considered the greatest of all time. This is before I saw that. This one takes the cake for me. I think Spike, who's also my favorite filmmaker of all time,
mm-hmm.
he speaks directly to me. A lot of, you know, I was there in the early 90s. Now, I wasn't outside per se, but I was there for a lot of what was happening in the early 90s. So he embodies all of that. You know, he was the voice for black folks at that point. You know what I'm saying? Especially black film. Like I said, he's the godfather of modern black cinema. Man, let's go back. The film was in development for a long time, going back to the 70s. I think, I want to say Richard Pryor had something to do with it at one point. I think he was like, I think it was like being shopped with him in mind. Yeah, at one point.
I can't see that.
Yeah, of course. And then, you know, it started to pick up steam throughout the 80s. You know, at this point, Malcolm's image, as you know, as with all things, you know, in the moment, it's kind of, you know, Malcolm is seen as the bad guy in the 60s. You know what I'm saying? And when he goes, and unfortunately, when somebody passes, that's when people go back and like, oh, you know, he was actually all right. They was actually all right.
Yeah.
You know what I'm saying? Yeah. So by the 80s, again, the rise of hip hop, a lot of these people, the young people at the time, they're growing up learning about Malcolm X. He's being name checked in songs by Public Enemy, X-Clan. Malcolm's stature is rising, all while Spike Lee is in Brooklyn starting his career with She's Gotta Have It, School Days, Do the Right Thing, Mo Better Blues. Around Mo Better Blues, it comes out that the Malcolm X film is going to get made, but it's going to be directed by Norman Jewison. Norman Jewison directed A Soldier's Story, starring Denzel, and I believe he directed, no, Richard Attenborough directed Cry Freedom with Denzel playing Steve Biko. Norman Jewison did something else, but his stature as a filmmaker was up there.
Fill in the roof.
So
the theater kids out there, that's my theater background, is Fill in the Roof, Norman Jewison.
So here comes Spike. Does something very ballsy. And Spike, listen, man, we love Spike, but that brother loved the camera and love the microphone around that time, because he used to always speak up on everything. Yeah, now he kind of, he kind of speaks when he has to now. Yeah. And I think with time he learned that he can't speak up on everything. But he comes out and he's like, look, with all due respect, you are not the man for this job. Ballsy.
Tell him, gotta tell him.
And by doing that, he throws his name in the hat, which is crazy. That's very, but you know, we all moved by something to do stuff. And I think that was God at play. Because he does that, the powers that be goes, here, fine. You wanted to be a loud one? I think Norman Jewison back off.
Yeah, I saw an interview with him, and he was like, all right, like, I don't want to, like, hey, I'm not going to step on Spike Lee. Because you're right, that context of the time, you can't get the man who did Do the Right Thing, and you can't not let him do Malcolm X.
Yeah.
Like, that's like, that's, you're talking about missing out on the best golden opportunity to tell one of the greatest stories ever told.
And, you know, he steps up, Norman Jewison backs off, and Spike goes in. Now, when Spike becomes a director, you got opposition from people that know Malcolm, because you've seen She's Gotta Have It, School Days. You're thinking, oh, this man is a farce. Well, them. This man is a farce. You know, that generation of black folks, they're not really understanding the hip-hop generation. All this, oh, y'all shaking y'all butts and doing the butt, and then, you know, She's Gotta Have It. She got multiple partners. It's irresponsible. This is in the day of AIDS. You got She's Gotta Have It. It's coming out. So, you know, this is all seen as irresponsible. And he takes it on. He takes on the criticism. Denzel Washington, who played Malcolm in an off-Broadway play, takes on Malcolm in this film. As they're making the film, you know, Warner Brothers wanted to cut. They didn't want it to be 3 hours. They didn't. It was going out, you know, it was going beyond the budget. They wanted him to shoot the Egypt scenes in the Jersey Shore.
I didn't know that.
Yeah, this is all. There's a book. I'm passing on to you, brother. There's a book about the making of that film. Spike is writing in a journal, and he's telling all of these things as it's happening.
Wow.
Very good book, by the way. Yeah, so the film runs out of money in post-production. Bond Company comes in and is like, yo, it's done. It's in the can. We almost didn't see Malcolm X, y'all.
Wow.
But
it was already shot, too.
Yeah, shot, and we almost didn't see it. But Spike reached out to prominent black folks. You know, Bill Cosby, Oprah Winfrey, Prince, Janet Jackson, Magic Johnson, Michael Jordan. And they all pulled up together to get the money to finish the film. And we got the film we got today. And that was his, that was his moment at bat to show and prove. And he exceeded far beyond expectations. That film, another one, perfect, beginning to end. That 3.5 hour, you know what's so crazy? The movie is like almost 3.5 hours. I have comfort films that I could watch. You know, I could watch anytime, all day, every day. Pootie Tang, you know, stupid shit that I could watch all day, every day, that I could just throw on and let it play. Malcolm X is one of those. I remember, I'll never forget, when I first got cable that had like East Coast, West Coast channels, Malcolm X came on HBO East, and I watched the film all the way through. And I said, yo, I'm going to HBO West. I'm going to watch it again.
Yeah,
six hours of Malcolm, like, that's what, that was the day I said, yo, this is my favorite film. I could watch, you know, some films that are too heavy, you know, you can only watch once in a while, and no, I could watch this any and every day. Denzel Washington, man,
this best is performance, this is maybe of all time,
this is the greatest of all time. I think this makes him my favorite actor of all time. You got on a to lesser degree, you got Angela Bassett right beside him, who does what she does.
She comes about halfway through the film.
Yeah, she does what she does as Betty Shabazz. Incredible. The music, the Terrence Blanchard, that score.
Oh, man.
It's like a damn superhero. Like, you know what I'm saying?
And not to cut you off, but that scene when Malcolm leads all the brothers to the hospital, and they're standing outside, and he gives that simple, like,
oh, the hand gesture.
Hand gesture, and the music just cuts out. It's just, the march, the everything, the editing, everything about that. That scene and that movie is perfect.
Yes. Yes. That scene right there, you know, he said it's too much power for one man to have. Like, that's the one. That's another one where the film is structured so perfectly. It's like, with biopics, and you know, and this falls victim to it too. You know, you can't tell the entire story. There's but so much story you can tell.
Right.
And you know, I know some people that don't like this movie because they're like, oh, it didn't talk about this and didn't talk about that. And it's just like, you know, It gave us 3.5 hours. It gave us what it can with 3.5 hours. Mm-hmm. But it just it's structured perfectly. You get Malcolm as, you know, Detroit Red.
Yep.
You get that. You get him in prison.
Mm-hmm.
And you're really seeing the evolution of a man. Like, mm-hmm. this is a film. This is one of those rare biopics that, like, it almost works just as good as a history book. Like, you know what I'm saying? You could show that. Yo, you want to learn about Malcolm X? Watch this film.
Mm-hmm.
And you can't do that with every film.
That's what's interesting. No, I was just going to say, too, because I've been listening to the audiobook of the autobiography of Malcolm X over the past few weeks.
That changed my life. That book changed my life.
Yeah, so I haven't read the book before. Mm-hmm. So I'm like listening to it, and you know, I'm gonna read it eventually. You
know, but don't do like LeBron. Read that.
Yeah, I'm gonna read it. Yeah, I can't be listening. But it's funny how accurate, not accurate, but how close to of an interpretation of the story is.
I read the book for the first time in eighth grade. And as I'm reading, I'm like, oh, shit, this is the movie.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I'm saying? Like, to even, you know, Malcolm's narration is taken straight from the book.
Mm-hmm.
So it's so close to it. Like I said, it's just as good as a textbook, man. And again, you're watching his evolution in this 3.5 hours. You're getting to know Malcolm. And you get the dread in your stomach when you know what is about to happen.
Mm-hmm.
When you get that double dolly shot of him with the Sam Cooke playing, one of the greatest shots in film.
Yeah.
Probably Spike's best use of the double dolly shot.
Mm-hmm.
You know what's about to happen. Mm-hmm. I just went to the 30th anniversary screening with my daughter.
Mm-hmm.
And she's watching the film because my daughter's a little cinephile in the making. She likes movies.
Hey.
9 years old. What's up? She could sit through a 3-hour movie. I took her to go see Avatar. She loved every minute of it.
Really?
Stayed up.
That's what I'm talking about.
Listen.
There's adults who can't stay up for 3 hours.
Yeah. Exactly. Right. So, man. And she didn't know what was coming up.
Mm-hmm.
I knew.
Mm-hmm.
And she asked me a question. I went to go answer it. I had a pit in my throat. I was about to start crying. I'm like, oh, this is about to happen. Like, you feel the weight of the loss of Malcolm, man. That mm-hmm. that shit cuts like a knife every time. That and the Ricky scene is two scenes that, to this day, I'm bawling like a child
mm-hmm.
when I see it. Especially the beautiful eulogy by Ossie Davis,
yes.
which was actually delivered at his funeral.
Really?
Yeah, word for word. That's the actual eulogy he delivered at his funeral.
Wow. I didn't know that.
Incredible film.
And then that beautiful, beautiful eulogy, and then to cap it off with all the kids.
Which has a young John David Washington.
Really?
The first kid that pops up, I'm Malcolm X. That's John David Washington, who ends up becoming a lead in Black Klansman.
Wow. Oh, full circle. That's full circle. That's I didn't know that. Yeah, that's again, every aspect about this movie, like you mentioned, is just so, it's intentional. Mm-hmm. I think they set out to tell a story that was, you know, that gave you the ups and downs
yes.
of Malcolm's life. So you get a full character of him, a full picture of him, not as, you know, just the media figure, you mm-hmm. know, the person, you know, who's an aspirational figure, but as a person, as a man.
And I'm sorry to cut you off, but let me just make something very clear about Malcolm X.
Mm-hmm.
And this might have some expletives. If you're not a fan of cursing, I apologize.
Mm-hmm.
Motherfucking director of Everything Everywhere, All at Once. Was it Dan Schnart? Folks, if you don't know, the director of Everything Everywhere All at Once. What did you feel about that? This is not a pylon, by the way, but what did you feel about his film? I thought it was okay.
You thought it was okay? I liked Everything Everywhere. I liked the movie.
He goes, he does the Criterion Closet, goes into the closet, pulls out Malcolm X, and calls it his favorite crime movie.
That was crazy. That's crazy.
Let me tell you something, folks. The Untouchables is a crime film.
Right.
Heat is a crime film.
Clockers
is a crime film.
Mm-hmm.
Set It Off is a crime film.
Right.
Malcolm X is not a motherfucking crime film.
Never. No.
Let's get that straight. Let's be... Don't do that. Don't do that. Like, but this goes to show you how they see our art at surface level.
Yeah.
Because I'm going through the comments on Twitter, and there's people saying, oh, it devotes time to him being a hustler as Detroit Red, and the way Spike sequenced the scenes was similar to Goodfellas, which could probably be true.
Mm.
But what is the overall message of the film? This is a biopic. This is this man's life. Mm. It is not a crime. It, they only see us at surface level with anything.
Mm-hmm.
And I mean, you could be the most liberal white person ever. You could be the most conservative. You still, there's moments where they fall into that trap.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's like LeBron James speaking up on social issues and somebody says, shut up and dribble. They only see him as an athlete.
Right.
He has no voice beyond that.
Right.
So with this film, they saw the crime. They saw the whimsical moments, right. You know, him chasing the
white woman. They saw the scene of him doing the Cagney impression, yeah, in the park. Yeah. Yeah.
And they call it a crime film.
Right.
That was so disgusting. And it's just bullshit.
Mm.
It's offensive almost. You know what I'm saying? I seen somebody in the comments like, yo, this is kind of racist. This is like passively racist.
Definitely racially motivated. I think the funniest part about the clip is like, you know, it's obviously the two directors, the white dude, mm-hmm. he's the one talking about the Malcolm X thing. And you see the Asian dude in the background, he kind of literally chuckles like when he says that. I'm like, yo, even his co-director's like, come on, bro.
Yeah.
Like, really? I feel like he wants to turn around.
That was
like,
such a shitty take. That's just such a bad take. Like, Malcolm X is the favorite crime films.
And again, I think I liked Everything Everywhere. I like those guys, but I think obviously, you know, it's just a problem with, I think, the way we talk about black cinema.
Yes,
you know what I mean, because we have, you know, he calls it a crime film. You know, he says he only saw it last year. He in the same clip he says he only saw Malcolm X for the first time last year. So it's like, what's kind of what I am led to assume. I don't know the guy. Maybe he's a good dude. I don't know.
Maybe. You
know what I mean? But I think like what the clip literally read to me is like, oh man, this dude might have saw this movie during Black Lives Matter.
Mm.
And then was like,
speak on it.
Yeah, I'm bored. Like, I didn't watch the rest. Like, I only watched the first hour and a half. Like, turned the rest of it off. Like, probably just watched until he got out of jail, and then when he started doing the conversion thing, probably tuned out. And that's honestly for a lot of people, that's honestly how far they get into Malcolm X.
Yeah.
For some people, that's literally the first hour and a half, which is madly entertaining. I definitely give you that. But they don't get to the part where it's the Reformation. They don't get to the part where he takes the pilgrimage. They don't get to the part where he is, you know, just the whole back half of the film is so much more moving. They see the part where he curses out the little white girl on the not curses out, but he's like, oh, like, nah, I don't need your help. Like, they see that and they're like, oh, that makes you know, white people frankly uncomfortable.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean? But then, you know, they don't. So then when it gets to the parts of the movie where it's Malcolm X's journey as a leader, and we starts to find out everything about
Elijah Muhammad.
There we go, Elijah Muhammad. I'm messing up names bad today. I'm just a little nervous.
It's all good.
But yeah, nah, it's like, yeah, when we get into that part of the journey, you know, it's not a crime. It's just not. It, like, it's about, it's life. It's a film about life.
Why would those words come out your mouth?
Yeah.
At that point, it is not a crime. Like you said, some people, he probably just saw that first hour and a half.
Yeah.
And left it alone. So it's just ignorance. Ignorance on his behalf. It's just a very ignorant statement. I hope he says something about it. But then again, you know how they move. They don't care.
Yeah, they're probably not going.
They say what they say. You got to live with it. Meanwhile, we got to apologize for the shit. I'm not going to go into that, people. But Malcolm X, man. You know, Spike talks about going to see Lawrence of Arabia with Ernest Dickerson, and that whole Egypt Mecca to date.
That's beautiful.
That's the only film that was allowed to be filmed on the grounds.
Really?
Yeah. So he had to get a whole second unit full of Muslims
really?
To go and shoot that. Yep.
I did not know that.
Yeah. So that's sacred ground. So, you know, that's the only film to date, one and only film to be shot at the Mecca.
Wow.
This film had everything across. It checks all the marks for me across the board. And, you know, of course, it came with a little controversy when it came out. You know, Spike telling kids, don't go to school, go see this.
Right.
Which, you know, could rub people the wrong way, even though I agree with it.
I agree. This is cool. Because they're not teaching this in history class.
Absolutely.
And that's to me was the most fascinating part when I first watched Malcolm X, when I was, you know, a teenager.
Mm-hmm.
It was all new. It was all new information. I didn't know he had the lifestyle he lived. I don't know, he went to prison. I don't know all of that. I just knew, you know, oh, he was a civil rights leader who, you know, made some people mad. That's literally all I knew. So, but then watching this movie gave me a new perspective, not just on, again, him as a leader, but as a person, seeing the goals that him and his fam, you know, him and Angela and all black people, like the conditions that he's around, like when he is walking down the street and he sees like somebody who, you know, from the community, like, you know, you know, asking them for what? I'm getting the scene wrong. When he's like exiting the apartment building and then he sees like one of his, I forgot that scene. Oh, no. The girl who he goes on a date with. It's like she's like tricking, right? Or she's like,
yes, Laura. Yeah. Laura, played by Teresa Randall. She plays Laura in the beginning of the film, the good girl that was at the, you know, the whole Lindy Hop scene with it.
Yeah,
another beautiful. Spike loves musicals.
Yeah,
and you could tell by the School Days and this one, he wants to make a musical,
right?
Bad as hell, like a song and dance musical. And that whole Lindy Hop scene is basically that.
Mm.
So he's going out with Laura. She's a good girl, Christian girl.
Mm.
Dips off with the white girl, does his thing with the white girl, and then we get Laura again, which later. That scene, Elise Neal is in that scene in the background. She plays one of these prostitutes, or a young Elise Neal, and we get Laura, and she's tricking by that at that point, you know, which is, look, man, this film is it. This is it.
It's just like those details that you wouldn't even notice, and most biopic directors, you know, just kind of zoom through, like, you know, no disrespect to the Whitney Houston movie, like,
it's a good movie,
it's fun, but they definitely, it's like the Wikipedia version of her life. It's like they only gave you like half of her Super Bowl performance, you know what I mean?
And you know, and to that point, you know, Malcolm X is the reason why I can't enjoy biopic films today, because this is the definitive one. This is the one that, like, it takes its time. Granted, again, it omits some things from his life, but it still takes his time to dealing with the things it wants to deal with.
Mm-hmm.
And it doesn't stray from it. You know what I'm saying? A lot of people at the time was upset that Spike was going to show Malcolm frolicking with white women and doing drugs and stuff like that. But it goes there.
Right.
It does not run from that. And yeah, man, this is the one. This is the one. And hey, that's voted the greatest black film of all time. I am on. Yeah. I'm on board with that. Now, with our top five, let me know. Is there any you would change? What you would add? Let me know.
Our top five, I like the, that's a strong top five. You know what I mean? I think that's as strong as of the top five you're gonna get.
Mm-hmm.
I would personally probably throw something a little more modern in there. Like, I'll probably throw Get Out in there.
Mm-hmm.
You know, or yeah, Get Out. Or I know Moonlight was on honorable mentions too.
Mm-hmm.
But those two are. I don't know, but that's the thing. I don't know what I'll take out. You know what I mean? Right. Out of those five, you know, that's a strong five right there.
Yeah, it's a strong five. Get Out might be top, might be five for me. I might start off with Get Out, then take it to House Party at number four.
Okay.
Number three.
You got to put Boomerang. I know you're talking about Boomerang. It's not on your list, not on your top five.
You know what? Get Out, House Party,
Boys in the Hood, okay.
And
okay.
I'm rounding out the top two Spike joints, Malcolm X and Do the Right Thing. Do the Right Thing being number two, Malcolm X being number one. That's my top five. You know, Get Out being number five, oof. Damn.
Yeah.
I think that it's a strong top five.
Yeah.
But I think, yeah, I think that's what I'm going with. Because if I want to go, it's just like your top, it's just like your GOAT list in sports. What is it that you're looking for? If I'm looking for quality and I'm looking for groundbreaking, like my top five in basketball, it deals with groundbreaking shit. Like, you know, eye test, of course, but whoever was really doing it. Like, I always say, you know, Larry Bird, Magic Johnson, Kareem, LeBron and Mike. You know what I'm saying? Man, if you look at each, they broke ground, or they would, you know, they kind of moved the goalposts. You know what I'm saying?
Right.
So for my top five, I think that's where I'm going to go, because Get Out is another one hell of a debut.
Yeah.
And then, yeah, the way it influenced modern horror today, you know what I'm saying? That we kind of dipping into social issues a little bit. And I remember when I seen that they announced that they was going to do a Get Out, and everybody was just laughing. I remember it hit Twitter. Everybody was kind of like, a film about, you know, a man, like, look who's talking, but horror? What?
Right.
I saw the genius in it already. I was like, if this brother knows what he's doing, he'll do it right. And he, that's another one of those ones. So, yeah, definitely Get Out, House Party, because I think that's just an important film. Boys in the Hood, Do the Right Thing, Malcolm X.
That's your five?
That's my five.
That's your five. I'll probably, if I had to go, like, my five, too, I'll probably, I think I'll probably switch Do the Right Thing and Malcolm X online. So I'll probably put Do the Right Thing number one. I'll probably put Malcolm X in my number two.
Okay.
You know what I mean? And then Probably put Friday as my number three.
Yep,
just because I love that movie. Even more than Boys in the Hood. You know what I mean? And really? I think Boys in the Hood is favorite. And like I said, it's one of the movies that really inspired my path towards filmmaking. The way I went to USC and things. But yeah, I Friday is just too funny to me. You know what I mean? And then yeah, probably five. I'll probably go with The Strong Get Out because yeah, that one is it's the combination of horror and comedy. I think it's the fact that it was so low budget, $2.6 million. It's like,
really, it was that cheap?
Yeah, yeah. Wow. The massive constraints, right? Like next to no money, but then it still doesn't, like, you can't even tell. It doesn't even feel like that.
Yeah.
That's one of the movies that I definitely vividly remember my theatrical experiences. Oh, yes. I saw it twice.
Same here.
First time I saw it, weird enough, was at a white theater at the Arclight Hollywood.
Same here.
And it was
that fun. Shit was like, that Get Out coming out was like a social experiment for me.
Because yeah.
I saw it in Jersey. I saw both of them in Jersey. I was in Jersey that weekend.
Mm.
I saw it at a white theater in the mall.
Mm.
And then I saw it with a bunch of colored folks, black and brown folks.
Same way I do.
And of course, the first viewing, white people was laughing. One scene that really showed me how disconnected they were was the scene at the end after, the dude that got his shit all mixed up, he kills himself, the white girl's dead, and the cop car pulls up.
Yeah.
In the white theater, they're like, oh, look at that. Oh, my God. Oh. All right. And in the black theater, they were like, ooh.
Yeah, yeah.
Like, audibly, everybody was like, oh, shit. Because that's the reality.
Mm-hmm.
This is the genius of... Jordan Peele is a master. He's officially on that list. After Nope, he's officially on that list.
Mm.
And the emotions he captures with just that image alone, like, oh shit, now a cop car is pulling up. In the wake of the Mike Brown and all that stuff that's happened, the Black Lives Matter movement, seeing it in two theaters was really a social experiment. I'm so glad I had the foresight to do that because I saw it the first time. I was like, yo, this was really good. And with the first friend that said it didn't see it, I was like, yo, I'm going with you today.
Yeah.
You know what I'm saying? And I knew what theater I was going to go to and everything. I was like, nah, I got to see this for myself. Right. I did that to myself. I wanted to experience that. You know what I'm saying?
Now, shout out. Yeah, same here. Shout out Baldwin Hills Scrimshaw Mall here in L.A.
Is Baldwin Hills movie theater still black owned?
It's a Cinemark now.
Okay.
Yeah. So it's owned by a company. But I don't know. I don't know. It might still be franchised by Magic.
It used to be black owned.
It was Magic. So
That was Magic's theater.
Yeah. That was Magic Johnson's original spot. And that was. I could talk all day about Magic Johnson theater back in the day. Boy, I saw some movies there. but yeah, that was it. I loved how. I love seeing it there because right there, also at that time too, was like, I was at USC, so I got to take like some white people from USC to see it with me too, you know what I mean? And Baldwin Hills Crenshaw is the closest theater to USC. A lot of people don't realize that, but a lot of people from USC don't realize that that's really the hood. So then like when I take them to see movies there, they're like, oh shoot. So seeing their reaction amongst all the black and brown people, like you said, reacting to certain scenes, like doing that, it was... all around, just perfect, man. This movie is Get Out. It would make my top five. It's another one that as soon as it came out, it almost immediately entered the film school lexicon of like movies, important black movies. Mm-hmm. Also, won mad Oscars and awards. I too think that if we just looking at our list, like Friday, House, I think House Party might be. Reginald Hudley's first film, right?
Yes,
it is. Yeah, and
based on a student film.
Really? Oh, yeah. I didn't know that. I didn't know that. Yeah, see, Hudley, Singleton, all these F. Gary Gray for Friday. All these first time filmmakers, literally just putting their all into these crazy Get Out. All these first time movies, debut movies. It's just like. To me, it's inspirational. Yes. To me, it's just like, yo, let me get cooking right now.
Absolutely.
I got a story to tell.
Absolutely. The black experience, the black stories, there's plenty. And, I saw a tweet the other day. Somebody said they listed Lena Waithe, Tyler Perry, Kenya Barris, and there was a fourth one there. Lee Daniels.
Yeah.
And they said... these four need to never make a movie again. And listen, I know how we feel about their art.
All right.
Trust me, I have criticism of, of at least three of them. Kenya Barris is okay.
I like Kenya, yeah.
You know, but I definitely got a thing to say about Tyler, Lena, and Lee Daniels. But I think that it's important that they all get a chance to tell their stories. We should never try to silence them because, as we know, black people are not a monolith.
Yes.
There's many different shades of black folks, and there's many stories to tell. Madea, yes, is a little off-putting at times, absolutely. But you know what? Go talk to somebody from Alabama, Atlanta, Mississippi. Everybody knows they have a big mama that they know is just like Madea. They love these films, these stories, you know? Lena Waithe. Again, I don't think she can write a film, but you know what I'm saying? But right. She speaks to a specific crowd. There's people that enjoy stuff. I often criticize Queen and Slim for being a Twitter. I feel like it's a black Twitter script.
Right, because, right.
But again, because you see that on there, it speaks to a crowd. You know what I'm saying? So I think we should all let everybody tell their stories. Everybody has different perspectives. We should never muzzle black voices, because while you're doing that, you're doing the devil's work. Because please believe, when you go into these, you know, you go into these offices, you be around these people that move and shake and green light stuff, they're looking for the one black thing that's either hot at the moment or they're reaching for. You know what I'm saying? We've seen with Hollywood Shuffle, when he's going on these auditions, they're looking for the Eddie Murphy type. You know, right now they're looking for the Kevin Hart type. So you never want to fall into these tropes. You know what I'm saying? So we should all give our filmmakers and our black creatives, just let them run the gamut. Let them do whatever they want to do. You know what I'm saying? Now, if you don't want to rock with it, that's okay. That's art. Art is to be critiqued. You don't have to rock with everything. If you don't like it, don't support it. It's okay. But let them do what they got to do.
Yeah, it's perfectly said. Eloquently said.
Now, that's it.
Wow. First episode,
we ended on a strong note. You know what I'm saying? Yeah. You know, I have to send y'all home with a little something. You know what I'm saying? Think about that, my brothers and sisters. Think about that. RB3, is there anything you want to sign off with?
Nah, man. You know what I mean? If you're watching on YouTube, you might be watching the First Cut YouTube channel. Make sure leave us a comment. Hit that like button and subscribe if you're not subscribed already. If you're listening to this on the audio, you know what I mean? Share the podcast. We're available on Apple, Spotify, all the podcast networks. So help us out and get us shown there.
Yeah, I would love to do this more and more. This is something I'm very passionate about. Again, thank you, RB3. This brother right here has helped me kind of get everything in line. You know what I'm saying? I knew this was an idea I had 10, 15 years ago. Before podcasts and all this stuff was a thing. You know what I'm saying? I thought that, I got to make it to TV to talk about this stuff. Well, look, we can do this now. You're listening to it. You know, check us out, Real Talk Film Society on IG. That's R-E-E-L, Talk Film Society. On Twitter, we're now verified.
Oh, shoot.
Real Talk Film S-O-C. Real, R-E-E-L, Talk Film S-O-C. Follow. We're going to have more of these coming. I'm going to have my quick take reviews. We're going to be posting retrospectives, celebrating black cinema. We will also be talking about other mainstream films because we're just giving our perspective on everything film.
Yeah.
So thank you for listening. I'm Mr. Marin signing out. See you later.